Good morning and welcome to the April 27th edition of Mountain Money. I'm your co-host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Kevin Kennedy, who spent the weekend entertaining the Park City locals with his performances at the Follies. Kevin, how are you holding up?
I'm getting tired, but shows are great. The crowds are fantastic, and it's all for the Egyptian. We love the Egyptian, don't we?
Okie dokie. Well, this morning, Kevin and I recorded an interview on Friday with Jan Dutkiewicz and Gabe Rosenberg, and we didn't anticipate that it would be quite as fascinating as it was, so we ended up talking to them for what is going to amount to the entire hour this morning.
Exactly. Well, it was a great conversation.
I hope you enjoy it. Their new book is called Feed the People, Why Industrial Food is Good and How to Make It Even Better.
Yeah, and we're going to do that in three sections, so stay with us. We'll be right back.
When I picked up a copy of the new book, Feed the People, Why Industrial Food is Good and How to Make It Even Better, I really wasn't expecting something that combines element of a buddy movement movie with fascinating observations about the way in which our food is grown and marketed. We're lucky today to be joined by authors Jan Dutkiewicz and Gabe Rosenberg to talk about their journey through the world of modern American food. Good morning, gentlemen, and thanks for joining us.
Hi, great to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So what motivated the two of you to write the book, and how long did it take to do the research?
So, Jan and I have known each other for about a decade. We started out presenting together at a conference that was kind of on our shared interest of animal agriculture. And during the pandemic, as a matter of fact, we decided that we wanted to spend some of the time that I think we otherwise would have spent sitting in our apartments, kind of wondering when the world was going to come back together, trying to write more for a general audience about what our academic research told us about animal agriculture. And so on the basis of that, we started to kind of sketch out a larger argument that wasn't just about animal agriculture, but was about food politics in a broader sense. It took us about, I would say, 4 years from conception to the book, Roger, that you've read. We're really proud of the results. It was, I think, as you put it, a lot of fun to do together. We are, I think we're a good pair, and it shows up in the kind of personality of the book.
It really does. The book is a journey, and you chose the Waffle House as a repeated element in the book, which is not something I would have expected. Let's talk about the role the Waffle House plays in the book and why.
Yeah, so the Waffle House is kind of our inspiration. And we juxtapose what we think is kind of like the fundamental ethos of the Waffle House. Let's keep in mind here, the Waffle House is open throughout the American South, essentially 24/7. And in a lot of towns and smaller cities throughout the American South, it's just about the only place that's open 24/7. It's about the only place that in the middle of the night you can go and sit down and get a cup of coffee and a plate of food. Generally speaking, people really, really enjoy the food at Waffle House. It's traditional American diner fare. It's kind of common ingredients as well as common recipes that people are familiar with. We wouldn't go so far as to say that it's particularly healthy food, although I suppose you can carve out perhaps a healthy meal from it. Our suspicion is that if you ate Waffle House all the time, it might not be the most healthy diet. But the thing that we notice is that it's a healthy serving of pleasure for the people who go there. And the people who go there are a really diverse mix of people. It's a really, really diverse in terms of class, in terms of race. Everybody can be found at the Waffle House. We like that ethos. It's kind of inspiring to us. It's not to say that Waffle House can't be better. And there's an entire chapter in the book, for example, that centers on what we think are the bad labor practices that Waffle House practices. But it is an idea that we kind of want to start with, which is, what are the pleasures that people actually take from the food system, and how can we improve those? In other words, a lot of food writing starts with the premise that we need to go from kind of like what we have now and what people enjoy now to something that's radically different and is entirely a different alternative. In other words, a kind of substitution or replacement of the conventional food system for something that gets called the alternative food system. And whatever merits that approach might have, we want to explore a different approach, which is to say, what if instead of coming up with a radically new alternative to things, we took a look at what people enjoy and we asked the question of how we can improve the average meal that's served, right? So we might have to put it this way, we would have a much better chance of really improving the food system in America, if we started with places like Waffle House that are already feeding a lot of people and producing a lot of pleasure. And so that's why we start with the Waffle House, and that's why we stick with it throughout the book.
Yeah, I like that. I like to start. The Waffle House is your muse in the whole thing. Is it an example of the food system that's broken?
No. So one of our arguments in the book is that this ubiquitous claim that you find everywhere that the food system is quote unquote broken is wrong. And it's wrong for two reasons. Number one, it's wrong conceptually. It's the wrong term to use to describe food system problems. You have to understand the food system as a really complex interplay of a lot of different actors, right? People tend to think, all right, there's a farm and somehow food gets from the farm to the end consumer, the end. But that's not the case, right? For a waffle to end up on a plate in a Waffle House in Decatur, Georgia at 2 a.m., you need North Dakota wheat farms. You need the technology from the fertilizer to the pesticides to the tractors that actually allows for the sowing and growing of that wheat. Then you need the transportation to get it to a processor. You need that wheat to be processed and milled. You need that to get to the Waffle House. There it has to be unloaded. The Waffle House exists where it exists because of zoning laws. The Waffle House kitchen looks the way it looks because of food safety regulations and worker safety regulations. Someone has to put that waffle on your plate. The price of that wheat is determined by the exchange of commodity futures on, you know, Chicago commodity exchanges. And that's just scratching the surface. And so, and this goes for every single commodity. That's just the waffle. And so this is a complex system. And so you can't say that a complex system is broken. It's just the wrong word. What you can do is you can look at complex systems and you can identify what works about them and what doesn't work about them, or what benefits they bring and what harms they cause, or what externalities they cause. It wants us to ask, number one, how do we produce the food we produce? Number two, why do we produce and eat the food we produce and eat? And then what are the problems? And then start approaching the problems one by one. And look, just realistically speaking, you cannot say in the United States of America that the food system is quote unquote broken. The average American can walk into their local restaurant or their local fast food joint or their local supermarket and for a relatively low price, and I'm saying relatively because I know that we've got some inflationary run-ups happening right now, but the average American can eat a relatively cheap, extremely varied, delicious, and potentially very healthy diet. Right? So whatever else is wrong with the food system, be it environmental issues, labor issues, health issues, questions of corporate concentration, those are problems that we can address within the structure of the existing food system, which on balance is one of the most bountiful and abundant and accessible food systems that has ever existed.
When you talk about attacking or understanding the food system and potentially changing it, you guys start by setting up a concept, by explaining a concept called democratic hedonism. Wonderful phrase. Can you explain what that is and why it's so important as you moved forward in the book?
So democratic hedonism is a claim that we should make producing pleasure for everyone in society and making it accessible to everyone in society, the object of our politics. And the idea here, we want to distinguish democratic hedonism from mere hedonism, right? So mere hedonism, we've all seen it. We've probably indulged in it ourselves. I think the example that we use in the book that seems to sing to a lot of people is the mere hedonist is the rich wino at the restaurant, who we've all seen, who's turned his alcoholism into a kind of like aestheticized hobby. And this is a person who's spending more time paying attention to the vintages on the menu than they are to the people around the table with them. Our argument is that hedonism alone is not particularly impressive because that's just selfishness, and we're not out here to defend selfishness. But when hedonism encounters democracy, and it forces us to recognize that our pleasures are provided to us in some senses by our social relations. So they're sustained by our relationships to other people, and to the planet and to animals and to all of these other things in the world, that when we sort of encounter that recognition, we come to understand that defending other people's pleasures and defending their access to that pleasure, right? Making sure that it's equitable, that it's accessible, that doing so is also the way in which we can defend our own pleasures. And so there's a call here for a general sense of solidarity about trying to make the world a more pleasurable place and to try to reduce the harms that come with that pleasure. We argue that this is theoretically, and we would argue probably like morally important. In other words, we think that there's serious moral worth in pleasure, but we also think that it's kind of practically important. We don't want a politics that's listless, that's ascetic, right? We don't want a politics of monks sort of flaying themselves, you know, mortification of the flesh here. That's not what we're about. We want to be, as the old saying goes, happy warriors. I don't know if that cliche necessarily has fantastic provenance, but that's our attitude, right? That we want our politics to be about creating pleasure and about reducing the harms that might go with it.
You spend a lot of time in that chapter talking about Wendell Berry. Why is he important?
It's dangerous, right? Because he's, if you've read Wendell Berry, you know that Wendell Berry is a beautiful writer. And I want to start out by saying that. I think people might interpret our encounter with Wendell Berry as us not having any respect for him. And in fact, he's a beautiful poet and a beautiful writer. His most important, I would say, non-poetic work is a book called The Unsettling of America, which really was kind of like a low-key hit for the American environmental movement and the early goings of the American sort of like new food movement of the 1980s and 1990s. And it's kind of a polemical work that makes a lot of arguments about essentially the need for individuals to get to know and to work with a farmer near them. So it kind of gives birth to the idea of locavorism. We think that's misguided in a lot of respects, and we can talk more about why locavorism is not a particularly workable or useful way to address what are pretty pressing problems with the American food system. But we also think that it gives a kind of fundamentally skewed and false vision of what pleasure is or how we ought to encounter it as a kind of phenomenological quality, which is to say that a lot of Berry's writing really assumes a very narrow and I would say cramped vision of pleasure, which is actually talking about the satisfactions of work. In other words, that you're going to take pleasure from something if you've spent a lot of time working to create it. That means, of course, that like the only truly pleasurable meal is the one that maybe you grew and that you cooked yourself. And as a general matter, I don't think that's particularly practical. I also think that it's fundamentally false. Not all people enjoy cooking. Not all people enjoy gardening. A lot of people do enjoy a Burger King. And there's a second level of problem there, that even at the theoretical level, we could say, oh, that's a false statement about pleasure, at least as a phenomenological quality, right? To say that it's an actual experience that people have. Even if you dismiss that and you say the person who enjoys the Burger King is suffering from food false consciousness, it doesn't matter. They still exist and they're still gonna be guided by their desire to eat the Burger King, right? So you have to come up with solutions that actually engage what other people say they like. You can't just hand wave it away. And that's the biggest problem with the locavore movement. At the end of the day, it provides a very, very costly and time-intensive way of feeding yourself. And most people don't find it pleasurable enough to justify those costs. Now, maybe they oughta. Unfortunately, they don't. You got to deal with the reality that they don't. And that really is a premise that the book starts to work from.
Personally, I mean, look, there's also a basic pragmatic element here, right? What the Wendell Berrys of the world, and of course, people like, you know, Michael Pollan and Alice Waters suggest is that eating the locavore way is feasible for everyone and a desirable way to structure the food system, right? So if you take Omnivore's Dilemma, so Michael Pollan's best-selling, completely discourse-shifting, discourse-forming book about, you know, tries to answer the question, in a world where you can eat anything, what should you eat? Look, Pollan spends a third of that book holding up as his sort of avatar of the ideal food system, Joel Salatin, who is a small-scale rancher. So let's just leave Joel Salatin's sort of libertarian politics out of this for a second. Michael Pollan is suggesting that the average American should and could eat from a small farm
that uses, you know, quote unquote, agroecological methods. It's quite simply not feasible. And it's not feasible for any range of reasons. Number one, land availability. Could we figure out a way without resorting to like Leninism or Maoism of redistributing land in this country in such a way that our food is produced by exclusively small farmers? I mean, probably not, because of who already owns land. So right away, you've got a political economic barrier. Number two, the feasibility of scaling that production. Could you feed Americans something resembling their current diet from small farms? And could you make that work logistically in a country where about 1% of people work in agriculture and over 50% of people live in cities? Can you make the logistics of that work? But the pollens of the world, the waters of the world, they don't answer these very basic pragmatic questions. And so they hold up as a food system ideal, something utopian that's simply not achievable, right? And so what they do is they hold out this vision of both a form of production and a form of consumption that cannot be reached by the average American, but that has the secondary effect of suggesting that there's this sort of pure and good and moral and healthy way of eating that's available to a small number of people that we should all aspire to but can't reach, and that everyone else is eating sort of inferior industrial diets that are somehow flawed. And that's just absolutely the wrong way of thinking about the ethics and the pragmatics of food system change.
I'm going to guess they've never sat down at a Waffle House at 2 a.m. in Decatur, Georgia, and just had a yummy waffle. Maybe they
just had the best meal of their life.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right? Which is affordable and widely available. And that's basically the argument we're saying. We're also not saying that the Waffle House is the ideal meal. We don't want to prescribe a particular diet to everyone. Like, if you like green smoothies made with kale, that's great. But what you also have to recognize is that that kale smoothie, the ingredients for it, if you got them, whether it's a Walmart or a Whole Foods, probably came to you through industrial modes of production and through industrial large-scale value chains.
Yeah.
Right? I don't think recognizing that the Waffle House waffle and the green smoothie come through the same logics of production and the same value chains and the same retailers is the first step to really starting to think about what works about the food system and also food system reform.
And that kind of naturally takes us to Iowa. What can looking at Iowa tell us about who produces what food and why?
So Iowa is an agricultural powerhouse. Close to 90% of the state is dedicated, of its landmass is dedicated to agriculture. For every one Iowan, there are seven pigs. But what Iowa does is it embraces industrial agriculture in the sense of large-scale production done efficiently. The problem is that Iowa also represents much that is wrong with American agriculture, because it uses this industrial efficiency basically for the wrong reason. What Iowa does, or let's take a step back. What American agriculture does, this sort of, or even global agriculture in the wake of the Green Revolution, is we're extremely good at producing crops. We can produce a whole lot of crops that are quite robust, and we can produce them really well and really efficiently. And for feeding people, that's fantastic. The problem is we're almost too good at it. So governments and agribusiness have tried to find ways of using that super efficient crop production for things that don't involve directly feeding people. And that's using it for fuel in the form of biofuels like ethanol and in the form of growing feed, which is to say feed primarily from corn and soy to feed to animals on factory farms. And so what we're doing is by doing that, we're diverting crops. And in the U.S., we're talking over 60% of our crops don't go directly to human consumption. They go to fuel and feed. So we're diverting all that land and all those resources to ultimately quite inefficient ends. And so Iowa, you've got this incredible place that could just be growing such a bounty of food. But instead, the vast majority of Iowa is planted with corn that's going to go to get burnt as fuel, or that's going to go to animal feed, and soy, which is going to be used for the same reasons. So Iowa, in a sense, is a place where the incentives are wrong, which shows you, in a sense, what we're doing wrong with production. Iowa also shows you what the political economy is of food in the sense of who actually produces our food. And we sort of schematize this in the book into three categories of actors. We say, first of all, there are the earners. The earners are basically the large farmers who... So about the 5% of largest farmers in the United States who produce the vast bulk of our food. So these are people who own big plots of land, really lean into industrial methods, and very often produce staple crops. And these are the guys who really feed America. There's a lot of talk about small farmers. If you look at the USDA numbers of farmers, it seems like there are millions of farmers, but out of those, really the top 2 to 5% by size make up the bulk of our production and get the bulk of income, just because for economies of scale to work, you need a lot of land. Second, there are land owners who are not, who count as farmers, right? And we're very clear in the book that farming should not be understood as an activity. That is to say, a farmer is not someone who farms. A farmer is someone who owns farmland and farming operations. Everyone else is a farm worker. And that distinction really matters in a place like Iowa, because the second category of farmer we identified are people we call the gentry. These are basically landowners who don't themselves engage in any farm work. What they do, much like the European gentry of centuries past, is they own land. And they own land which they then rent out to other people to farm. And they do this quite simply because renting out land is good income, but also land itself is expensive. So if you can rent land and cover the costs and gain an income from it, you're now very land rich, even if you yourself don't farm. And finally, we turn to this category that we call, perhaps a little too tongue-in-cheek in hindsight, the noble losers, who are the small farmers who want to farm using environmentally sustainable, small-scale methods that engage in good land husbandry, potentially good animal husbandry, you know, the type of farmers that the Michael Pollans of the world love, that the average Whole Foods shopper loves. And what we show is that the challenges facing these people are just really immense. It's really hard to stay in business farming in that way in the United States because your per unit costs are expensive and you have to cultivate a clientele that's going to cover your higher per unit costs. And it's very hard to then transfer that form of production into mainstream value chains and into mainstream retailers who expect a really steady income of product of a set quality on set time horizons at a set price. Which, of course, if you're a giant factory farmer, you can tell Walmart, we're going to get you X tens of thousands of pounds of standardized bacon on the first of every month or every 2 weeks or what have you. Whereas if you're a small-scale pig producer who has maybe 100 pigs on their property, you just can't do it. So you have to find alternate channels to sell your food. And so this is kind of a sad story because the people who want to do non-industrial or perhaps more noble farming just have the odds stacked against them. Land's expensive, per unit costs are higher, and getting steady buyers is more difficult. So we actually profile a pig farmer who does everything right. He's doing well for himself, but he's not doing well for himself by feeding the average American. He's doing well for himself by selling his ultra premium pork to really expensive farm to table restaurants and to people willing to pay, you know, $6, $7, $8, $9 for a pork chop in places like New York City or Los Angeles or as far away as Japan. And so that's basically the structure of American farming. And where we're going with this, though, is that we need policy to create the right incentives for people to grow the right things. If we want more small farmers, we need way more small farming grants that makes doing small farming and alternative farming much less of a business risk. But if we really want to shift how the American food system looks, we need to do it through policy. If we don't want to waste land in Iowa growing so much ethanol and so much biofuels and burning food instead of growing food for humans, we need to get rid of biofuel incentives and biofuel subsidies. That's the only way to do it. If we want to grow more crops and less animal feed, we have to either eat less meat as consumers or we have to make factory farms way more expensive and onerous to run, right? That we need better legislation on everything from manure lagoons and plumbing to air quality to water quality effects. You need to raise the prices on bad ways of producing food because the most food system incentives point people towards producing cheap food poorly with a lot of externalities. And that's a policy question and not an individual consumer question.
Yeah, but of course those big factory farms have the power to lobby in Washington, and the small farmers who were, you know, like you just mentioned, don't have that power, don't have a lobby.
Yeah, that's right. And I would go a step further, is that they're far less numerous than you might think.
In fact, a lot of the people who you would want to think about as like the noble losers are first generation farmers who may not even come from an agricultural background, are highly motivated by ideological concerns and are trying to get into a new industry, right? So not only is there not necessarily a muscular lobby pushing in their favor, but in addition to that, they're actually on the outside of existing agricultural lobbying groups. And I want to be very clear here. Like, we can say that like the Farm Bureau is not looking out for small regenerative farmers and that it's only looking out for the big commercial farmers. But that is an actual agricultural lobby in the United States that does in fact represent actual farmers. It's not the farmers we may like. It may not be the farmers that Michael Pollan and Alice Walker like, but Alice Waters likes. But it is actually a very, very efficient, mercilessly so, lobbying organization. The thing that I want to note here then is like, what sense does it make if you're interested in large scale sort of like reform of the food system to foreground a political alliance between eaters and farmers? There aren't a lot of farmers. It's not a lot of votes in that, right? There's not a lot of votes available by creating that alliance. And you may also misrecognize who are the farmers you should be allying with and who are the farmers who are selling you a line of manure, okay? What we argue in the book is that there is a much better and we think more sensible political alliance to be made between eaters, that is consumers, a lot of the people listening to this right now, and workers. And that includes agricultural workers. In other words, the people who receive wages, but go and work on farms, you know, picking crops, working in processing plants. It includes workers further down the supply chain. So that includes people driving trucks. That includes servers at restaurants. That includes short order cooks. It includes everybody who's working at the Waffle House, but it also includes everybody working at the Whole Foods. You know, there are 30 million people doing those jobs. And that's 30 million people who can be out there pushing the argument that we need to have a fairer, more sustainable, and certainly more resilient food system. That's available to us, but we're not going to get it done by pushing this locavore line, which says, go out and meet your farmer. I got bad news for you. If you go out and meet your farmer, you're probably going to meet a rich, like, rural conservative. Demographically, that's who they are. Mm-hmm. You may not share a lot of political interests with them. You may not, in fact, share an idea of what a better food system looks like. I think that most people who are interested in progressive food reform will find that the workers in the food system are the ones that are a much more natural partner for that kind of political coalition. It's going to be more stable, and it's certainly going to pack a much bigger political punch. And so, you know, that's not to say that like regenerative or agroecological farmers can't join in productively in such an alliance, but they can't be steering it. And the purpose of the alliance cannot necessarily foreground their interests, which are at many times going to be naturally opposed to eaters who they're selling to.
I want to touch on the concept of meatification, because you made a reference to that, Jan, when you talked about the significance of meat in our diets. What do you mean by meatification, and why do you think the true cost of meat is not captured in the price paid by the consumer?
So the concept of meatification comes from Tony Weiss. He's a geographer at Western University in Canada. So it's his term, and what he's referring to is the remaking of the food system to serve an increasingly meaty diet. So what he's saying is the fact that on average, globally, we're eating more meat than ever. The average American eats 220 pounds of meat or more each every single year. That's not just a question of there being more supply to meet more demand. In order to have that supply, you actually have to really remake a lot of the food system. We now produce most animals in factory farm settings. Or when it comes to cattle, we're talking about industrial feedlots, about 99% of chickens in this country, about 97% of pork, probably north of 60% of cattle come from industrial feeding operations. In order to produce animals in those settings, in those quantities, and just to give you an idea of the quantities, we raise and kill over 9 billion with a B chickens in this country every year.
we need to dedicate a tremendous amount of resources to making that possible. And that means that for every animal that's not grazing by itself out on land, you need to use land to grow crops, to feed it. So now you're sort of intensifying animal production and putting the animals in one place, you're externalizing a lot of land production. In order to grow all those crops, you need to use more fertilizer. You need to use more pesticide. You're going to have more eutrophication. And simultaneously, the more animals you produce, the more greenhouse gas emissions you have. If you have more cows, you're going to have more cows that are belching methane into the atmosphere. If you have more pigs and chickens on factory farms, you're going to have way more manure placed in outdoor lagoons. As that breaks down, you've got more methane emissions. So meatification is the remaking of the food system around the mass scale production and consumption of meat, which carries with it a tremendous amount of environmental impacts. Never mind impacts on labor, right? So slaughterhouse jobs are the most dangerous jobs in terms of injuries per 100 workers per year in all of American agriculture. And when we're talking about the scale of impact, right, like livestock make up, we use twice as much land for livestock grazing and feed globally as we do for crops grown directly for humans. Livestock make up about somewhere between 12 and 16% of all greenhouse gas emissions from the entire global economy. So we're talking about major, major environmental impacts to feed our appetite for meat. And when we write in the book, and again, this comes from research, a lot of research out of scholars at the Martin School at Oxford University. What they're basically saying is that meat is artificially cheap because they can externalize all these impacts. They can externalize the climate impacts. They can externalize the impacts on our waterways. They can externalize the massive drawing of water. And that doesn't get priced into the final cost of meat. So meat is artificially cheap. If the real cost of meat involved the quantified sort of measure of the impact that it's having, that it's externalizing onto the environment, and that was internalizing the price of meat, meat would be far more expensive. So just to give you an example, we write about an experiment that was done in Germany on this very topic. So the German low-cost retailer Penny, in association with a bunch of researchers from a few German universities, they did an experiment where they would reprice items at Penny based on this true cost accounting, this environmental true cost accounting. And what they found is that, you know, the price of a block of tofu goes up maybe 2%. The price of beef goes up 76%. The price of yogurt goes up 36%. And obviously this is a small scale experiment, but what it also shows is that faced with the real costs, consumers change their purchasing decisions, right? Because paying $4 for a pork chop versus $7 makes you rethink your consumption. And so that's what we're talking about. And I just want to say that, you know, when we're talking about these externalities, I mean, these aren't just abstract things like parts per million of CO2 emissions in the atmosphere. We're talking about things like the Colorado River running dry. I'm sure you guys have covered this. Look, the Colorado is the single biggest waterway in the Western United States. Something north of 70% of all water from the Colorado goes straight to animal feed crops, right? And most of that is alfalfa. Alfalfa, which is feed for cows on feedlots and which is feed for dairy cows on dairy cow operations. You know, so people say these things, you know, like, oh, the water in the Colorado is low. The people in Denver or the people in Phoenix need to stop watering their lawns, or we should have golf courses. It's like, look, whatever your feelings are about lawns and golf courses, the real problem is that 3/4 of that water is going to alfalfa, and much of that alfalfa isn't even staying in the United States. Much of that alfalfa is going abroad. It's getting exported to countries that can't produce their own alfalfa. So we're basically running the Colorado dry so we can have cows, so people in more arid environments can have cows and they can have dairy.
Yeah, alfalfa definitely holds a lot of water. Okay, so one of my favorite parts of the book is when Gabe channeled his inner Morgan Spurlock to go on an all-Huel diet. What is Huel, and why did you take on the experiment?
So for people who don't know, Huel is this like nutritionally complete mule replacement system. And the essential, so you may have heard of Soylent, and this is one of the alternatives, but it's an ultra-processed food line where each one of the meals is basically
macronutritionally identical. So it has the same sort of distribution of nutrients, calories, and things like protein. So the idea here is that, like, for most people, you can take like a Huel meal, which might be like a cup that you microwave and it's like a pasta bolognese, or it could be like a shake or something like that. It's almost all made from highly processed pea protein. That's the thing I want to note. It's also it's vegan, so it has very, very low sort of like environmental impact, and that's one of the other benefits of it. And you can take it and you can just like eat it on the run. Like, it's really easy just like microwave it or eat, or, you know, chug a shake or something like that. It's got a lot of protein. This is very, very popular, by the way, with young professionals who like to work out a lot. If you go to a gym in America, you may see people with like a Huel t-shirt. They give you a free Huel t-shirt if you eat too much of it. So people who have read food books know that there's always this like kind of stupid conceit where the author like does like a self experiment and follows some sort of like crazy diet. So most famously, Morgan Spurlock in Supersize Me, where he eats only McDonald's. More recently, a book on ultra-processed foods, where the author ate a diet of 80% ultra-processed foods and got really, really sick. So we wanted to kind of like test the claim that you can't come up with a healthy diet composed of ultra-processed foods, because we have some larger concerns about this category and how it's used today in food discourse. And our general claim is that there are a lot of like unhealthy ultra-processed foods, but the category itself also happens to catch a lot of foods that are not unhealthy and that actually can be eaten regularly within your diet, and that in fact may have a lot of benefits. Otherwise, they may be nutritionally enriched in important ways, or they may have additives that make them more shelf stable while at the same not generating any kind of like health problems. And our general attitude around this is that those good ultra-processed foods shouldn't be demonized. In fact, they may be the key to making food more accessible and making it more nutritious for people who don't have a lot of time to spend on cooking. So the idea here was we were going to one-up the dude who had done an 80% UPF by coming up with a 100% ultra-processed food diet by eating all Huel for an entire month. And I did it.
A whole month.
Folks. A whole month. And it was misery. It was terrible. Oh, it was awful. I was nearly driven mad by the process. But I want to tell you, I have to say, in defense of Huel, that it was not because Huel is bad. In fact, I still eat Huel. I plug it into my diet maybe a couple of times a week when I need something fast. Huel is perfectly delicious from my perspective. It also was not nutritionally problematic. I lost a little bit of weight because it's very easy to calorie control, so I wasn't overeating. My blood work stayed the same. I actually had a new personal record in the Turkish getup, which for listeners who are kettlebell users will know what that is. I did a 62-kilogram Turkish kettlebell getup. So I was able to maintain my physical activity. And the thing that really got me about my all-Huel diet is that it was a really tedious and unpleasant way to eat. Because once I recognized that everything that I was eating was processed pea protein, the delicious strawberry shortcake shake became a pea shake. And once you learn that information, you can't unlearn it. Like, you know, you're like the pasta bolognese, and you're like, oh, it's pea bolognese in with pea noodles. Okay. You get tired of it. But you know what? This is the thing I want to say about that is that, like, that would have been true if I had eaten a diet exclusively composed of chicken breasts and broccoli. I don't eat chicken, but nevertheless, like, if I had eaten that diet, I would have gone bonkers within a couple of weeks as well. It's just the repetitiveness of it. So we just really quickly draw a couple of big conclusions from this. Number one, there are good UPFs, and they can be integrated into your diet, and they can be done so nutritionally like healthy fashion. And that the demonization of all UPFs in this fashion is not only scientifically and empirically like without basis, but it actually runs the risk of tossing out a bunch of foods that we ought to be eating, okay? Number two, don't underrate the importance of pleasure to any kind of attempt to alter diet towards more nutritious ends, okay? If a diet isn't pleasurable, it won't be sustainable. Okay, so all of these Baroque, extraordinarily complex diets that health influencers are pushing on Instagram or on TikTok or wherever else your listeners might encounter it, if it's complicated, and if it's not pleasurable, and if it's an onerous task, you may lose some kind of weight to begin with, but you won't stick with it, and the weight will come back, right? So don't underrate how important pleasure is always going to be to food choice. And that's something that we carry across the entirety of the book, is that, like, if the diet isn't pleasurable, if we can't serve up the food that people actually want, really nothing else matters. Because they're not going to go along with it. They're not going to stick with that diet. And that's true about an all-UPF diet. It's as true as any of the diets pushed by health influencers, but it's also true of a locavore diet that requires you to eat, you know, only root vegetables in the winter because that's what's locally available.
Yes. With our modern society, we have choices. We can eat the root vegetables. We can eat the pea protein and then at 2 a.m. go to Decatur, Georgia and have a waffle and maybe a side of bacon.
Exactly. But look, the flip side of the whole ultra processed thing is there are all kinds of good uses of food technology that we lean into in the book, right? So let's say someone is eating a burger, and a burger is the product of meatification we just talked about, and it's bad for the environment, not great for animals, obviously. How do you tell that person to change their diet? And we're quite, despite their recent poor performance in the market in the United States, it bears noting, not in the rest of the world, we're really supportive of, for instance, things like Impossible Burgers, Beyond Burgers, because what they do is they offer someone something pretty close to that burger experience, right? Consumers make most of their purchasing decisions based on price, taste, and habit. And it says, look, this has less impact, but it's pretty close. So the theory of change there is to reduce the switching costs for consumers. Don't say, you know, you only have to eat tofu like some kind of joyless vegan from the 1990s, you know. You can just eat a burger, but it's just a better burger. And yes, it's ultra processed, but that doesn't mean anything because what matters is what we process, not whether it's processed. And similarly, we're also quite bullish on, in the long term, on cellular agriculture, which is growing animal tissue from base cells, which is starting to be banned in a few states, even though the technology doesn't really exist. But if the technology comes to fruition, we think that that's also a big coup of, synthetic biology and food technology to give people a really good food.
So our steak is going to come from a lab?
It would come from something more akin to a brewery.
Okay.
I like beer. The technology exists to basically take base cells from animals and then feed them a growth formula, much as the cells would consume from your own body in terms of calories and protein, and produce meat. And there are companies that can do this with chicken breast, companies like Upside. There are companies that can do this with salmon. There's a company called Wildtype in San Francisco that's doing this. Now, the technology is still, I think, a few years away from real fruition or market viability. But if it happens, you know, you're producing completely pure and it bears noting unprocessed meat. The meat itself is not processed. It's real meat, just grown in a completely different fashion. And so, you know, if this works, this would be a big environmental coup, and it would let Americans basically have the meat they want without the massive externalities of meat production. And of course, the meat industry realizes this. This is why before this technology is actually valid, they're starting to ban it. This technology has been banned in Florida. It's been banned in, there's a moratorium on it in South Dakota. It's been banned in Texas.
No surprise.
And why is this being happened? Why is that technology that doesn't even exist being banned? Like, shouldn't Americans support innovation and sustainability and American science and American businesses? Well, you know, the meat lobby is pushing legislators to not even give Americans the choice. And obviously that's a problem, right?
This is a huge cell phone on the United States. The United States was the leader in cellular agriculture, and we're working to ban it and to inhibit the ability of these companies to produce what could be really world-changing technology. This technology is still going to be developed, right? It's going to be developed in China, and it's going to be developed in other places by other companies, and the benefits of the technology, as well as how it's used, are going to be decided by other people. it's kind of a ridiculous thing. We are banning this not because the technology doesn't show promise, but because it runs the risk essentially of pushing to the side American agribusiness interests who happen to have more pull at the White House right now, or at least within the Republican Party. And I think that's ridiculous. The other thing that I would say about it is, you know, people are a little bit afraid of cellular agriculture, and they don't like the idea of, say, you know, eating a steak grown in a test tube or something like that, which, again, it's more like a brewery than it is a laboratory. You know, when we talked to the CEO at Wildtype, which is the startup that does cellular agricultural salmon, he said something that was really, really interesting. He said, you know, I love it when people talk about the purity of food. He's like, because I got into this so that my wife could eat sushi when she was pregnant. And why is that? Because wild type salmon has zero mercury. Like, compare their salmon to the salmon that you get at the grocery store, and you're going to find it is a much purer product, right? It's purer to levels of kind of like laboratory scale production. And that's something that I think in the long run is probably going to be pretty compelling to consumers, that it turns out that a lot of the meat that's currently produced does not really fit anything resembling either natural or pure. And once you kind of toss that out the window, I think that cellular agriculture has a lot to offer, and people are going to find it that way.
You know, we've just touched on something that goes right to policy issues. And I think I want to finish by talking a little bit about the key policy changes that each of you would advocate with respect to food. I think that's part of what you want the reader to take from the book. Want to start, Jan?
Yeah. So one thing we haven't really touched on today is food security and insecurity. So food prices are going up. About 14, 15% of Americans at any given moment are food insecure. And addressing food and, you know, no American should go hungry in a country as wealthy as the United States. And addressing that is a policy issue. And so I think what I would want people to understand regarding food insecurity is, number one, it's a budget. It's a household budget issue. So all kinds of policies that aren't necessarily food policies are actually food insecurity policies. So be it rent freezes, be it building more housing, making housing more affordable, higher minimum wages, all of these things are food security solutions that would help people not be food insecure. But as far as food policy, look, SNAP, which is currently being cut back, SNAP is absolutely necessary to keep Americans well-fed. We, in fact, think SNAP should not only be expanded, but its eligibility should be changed to be pegged to cost of living. Currently, SNAP requirements are a fixed baseline, while SNAP payouts are on a sliding scale, tied to cost of living. So someone in New York gets more SNAP money than someone living in rural Oklahoma, for instance. But we think eligibility should also be tied to cost of living. So that's number one. We're big proponents of SNAP. You know, like, we could have debates about whether SNAP recipients should be able to get sugary drinks, things like Coke. We don't think these debates should be dismissed outright. We talk about this in the book, but leaning more into SNAP and funding SNAP is absolutely necessary. Number two, look, the absolute best policy for addressing food insecurity in this country are universal school lunches. School lunches take a lot of financial pressure and stress off parents. They feed kids. They increase school performance of children. So having universal school lunches in this country funded at a federal level rather than jurisdiction to jurisdiction would be an absolute game changer, and is absolutely something that I think on a bipartisan basis we should, all Americans should get behind.
Dave, we got about a minute and a half left.
So Jan took the universal school lunches, which is everybody's favorite policy.
Yes.
It's unbeatable. So I'll plug that too. So I'm going to talk about two. Number one, across the board, we need to go through the laws dealing with regulation of the food system and close agricultural exceptions. So currently, for example, laws about pollution, laws about water runoff, laws about air quality, all of these things have substantial carve-outs for agricultural operations. The same is true of America's labor regulations. The same is true of America's welfare, animal welfare regulations. All of these things are carve-outs that make possible the most corrosive and most socially harmful problems within the American sort of agricultural system. So we got to close all of those loopholes and end the practice of agricultural exceptionalism writ large. Number two, we need to start getting serious about public investment in good technology for agriculture and food science. The United States lacks a national laboratory for food science. We lack adequate funding to do the basic science that's necessary to develop better gene-edited crops that are not merely corn and soybeans. These are things that require serious investment, and they are serious market failures in the moment. Government needs to step in and correct those things. That's going to take money, that's going to take resources, but it's going to go to creating more sustainable, healthier, and hopefully a fairer food system. So those are the kinds of policies that we support.
We've been speaking with Gabe Rosenberg and Jan Dutkiewicz. They are the authors of Feed the People, Why Industrial Food is Good, and How to Make It Even Better. Guys, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
It's our pleasure.